Compassion Plans, Episode 10, Saving the Third World.
The world we live in is far from perfect. How can I effectively make a difference? This is Compassion Plans, a weekly interview to help you make the world a better place with your host, Bentley Davis.
In Honduras, we were taking gang members off the streets.
We were kidnapping them out of the gangs.
In Honduras, the gangs kidnapped the president of the country's son and said, "We want $1 million or you're going to kill him." They killed him.
Welcome to Compassion Plans. I'm Bentley Davis, and I have Nick and Gavin that are going to share a little bit with us about nonprofits. Welcome to the show, guys.
Hey, it's good to be with you.
Thank you, Bentley, for having us.
So, guys, I like normally starting talking about compassion, which is about reducing someone else's pain. So what pain are y'all about reducing?
For me, for Nick, personally, I love to reduce the pain of being locked or in bondage to something. So my biggest desire is to have freedom myself and to see other people free. So that would definitely be mine. I don't know. What about you, Gavin?
The pain point I like to help people through is that they can be their own boss and start their own business, and they can have a financial freedom that is possible.
That's awesome. Now, those are two completely different things.
Well, have you met us?
We're two completely different people.
We've
been married for almost 17 years come September.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, no, at some point in the past, y'all told me y'all were working on a nonprofit. Was that together on the same thing?
We did. In 1999, Nicole and I started a nonprofit called Servant's Heart. We were living in Orlando at the time, and a friend of ours, Art, is a judge, and he went to Honduras and met this little girl with eight brothers and sisters living in this tiny house. It was probably 8 feet by 8 feet.
Yeah, it was small.
And
no electricity, no water.
The girl's mother carried her about 3.5 miles on her back and said, "Can you help my daughter?" And the girl was blue. She had a genetic birth defect, and basically all the doctors said, "This little girl is going to die."
All of her organs actually were on the other side of her body.
They're all upside down. It looks like somebody took her organs on an x-ray and just scrambled them around.
It was really insane.
So my friend's a judge, and he's like, "You know, I don't accept that this girl's going to die. I just don't accept it." Now, he's not a doctor. He's a judge. So he called us from Orlando and said, from Honduras, and said, "Hey, you know, my credit card's in my house. Can you enclose my garage by the time I get back?" I'm like, "Yeah, I think I can do that. We can do that." So we started enclosing his garage while he was in Honduras. He started making phone calls, and his family's pretty politically connected.
Yeah.
So within about 4 phone calls, he had her a passport to the U.S.,
and a doctor
in the U.S. who was Honduran, who would do the surgery for free. And in like 2 weeks, this girl with her mother is here in Orlando.
For like several months.
Now, these people come from a very small agricultural town. And we took her, like, the mother to Publix, and she saw the meat, and she's like, "I've never seen this much food in my life."
Yeah, it was crazy.
And it was just mind-blowing to see that we brought her here, the little girl, and she wanted to save like every bottle cap. Because everything was a memory to her.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
She was not hoarding, but she was. Because under her bed in her room, she had her own room. She's never had her own room. She's never like had her own bed.
She's never had electricity.
She's never had electricity.
I mean, they literally would get water from a well.
So anyway, we fell in love with this girl. And she was here for about a year or so.
Yeah, like almost.
And you know, we said, "You know, we need to buy our house. We can buy our house for about $12,000. So we saved up money with a church we were in Orlando. And they bought her a house. Well, they said, "Hey, we need some people who are relatively handy to go down and fix up this house." And this was in like the summer, in like June, July or something. I said, "Okay, let's go down." So my wife, Nicole, and myself and a team went down to Honduras, this little girl.
God, I thought we were going to die.
Little girl's village that's about 1,000 degrees. And I'm from Florida, and this place is hot.
Yeah. And they call it hell.
And we fixed up her house. And we were on the plane to leave at the like end of the week. And I'm like, wow. I know what, if I know anything in my entire life, I know I'm going to be living in this country. And I don't like this country.
Right. Let me tell my heart. So during the week, Gavin and I got deathly ill for the 2 days we were working our butts off.
We got like a heat stroke.
And yeah. I remember saying to myself, there's no way I could ever live here. I remember saying it to myself several times. This place is like the armpit. There's no way. So we're on the plane leaving, and I'm thinking, we're leaving.
Take off. They're wanting the engine.
And Gavin is hitting my knee going, "Nicole, this is going to be so amazing. We are going to come back here, and we are going to live here, and we're going to build houses for people. And we're going to do all this." And he's telling me all these ideas. And I'm looking at him, patting his knee, going, of course we are, honey. Sure we are. I'm totally placating him. I'm like, whatever. There is no way you're getting me back. And then 5 months later, so this sold everything. And moved
that's like July. So between July and December, we sold everything we owned. We started a nonprofit organization.
That's crazy.
And like a week before Christmas, we were in Honduras living there.
December 23rd, we got
December 23rd, did not speak a lick of Spanish.
So in 6 months?
We left the country in 6 months with $5,000.
Well, ironically, Gavin lost his job. So then I was still working. He was like, well, I can work on the nonprofit. Because it actually does take a while
to do
the nonprofit. And I think back then it was $500. You need $500 to start it. And Gavin's dad's a lawyer, so he helped us with the paperwork. And,
well, and
so he could get ready, basically, because he didn't have a job anymore. And help, you know, we sold everything and just did whatever. I mean, we didn't have kids at the time. And
basically, getting a nonprofit is fairly easy. It's about four steps. And if you know the four steps, the hardest part is downloading the thing from the internet, the application, and filling it out. If you can do that, you can have a nonprofit.
You have to be specific on what
you have to make out budgets and kind of estimates.
I have heard that it is still that simple, but the approval process, now they're backed up. And it's taking almost a year to get approved.
Ours came back a couple times. And that's why we brought in Gavin's dad, because we were like,
ours came. Mine came back once. He had a question about something. But you're making budgets for 5 years, and we had no clue.
And you don't have any clue. You're just
I'm completely making stuff up.
We want to save the world. We want to build houses.
We want to help people. We want to build houses. There's, you know, a hurricane went through Honduras, and people live in basically under tarps.
Yeah.
So I'm like, hey, listen, I want to go down there and build houses. And we did. So, we, you know, 6 months later, we're down there. We have a nonprofit. We're taking pictures. We're building houses. I think the first year we built like 35 houses or so in his village. The girl with the heart, we kept going back and forth to her village all the time. I said to those kids, I said, look, as much school as you want, I will pay.
Yeah,
if you get into it, I will pay for it. And actually, her brother is in his, fifth year of med school?
I think it's sixth year.
Yeah, and it's getting expensive. I'm like, man, I can't do this.
Yeah, I'm actually going to put it on my podcast, believe it or not.
But, if anybody wants to sponsor a kid in med school, it's not
having a son that isn't really ours.
But he's got seven brothers and sisters, so we're going to put him through med school, and he's going to support the rest of the family. And we've gotten him this far. He's got a year left. It's been 12 years now. It's been since 19.
Well, and the judge and his wife, they're doing a business down there making jewelry.
Yeah, we've kind of changed the dynamic of this family. And, you know, the first year we were down there, we built houses and did a feeding program. The second year, we did kind of a thing with a group of organizations to kind of unify them. And we were also getting involved with an organization called Teen Challenge, which is not exactly teens. But in Honduras, we were taking gang members off the streets.
We were kidnapping them out of the gangs.
In Honduras, the gangs kidnapped the president of the country's son and said, we want $1 million or you're going to kill him. They killed him. Well, the president said, okay, if you see anybody with gang tattoos, kill him. Pull him off the bus and shoot him.
And that's what they did.
All of a sudden, we got all these kids that want to get out of the gang. Well, the gangs down there, you can't mix them. So we basically bought a farm. Or with an organ with Teen Challenge International and had all the gang members. It's like me.
And we did mix them. It was 40
gang members.
Yeah,
I'm thinking, what have I done?
Yeah, crazy.
Yeah.
All right. So I have a question for you.
Okay. Go ahead.
What have y'all been smoking?
This is our normal.
This is how you normally
are. This is how we roll.
Yeah.
All right. Let me ask a serious question. If you met someone and they said, oh, I just went off to not Honduras, but maybe someplace in Africa and say, I saw this need that they have there, and I want to do something to help them out. So I need to start a nonprofit and all this stuff. There's no one operating in that area right now. There's no other organizations I could get with in this area. How do I get started?
Well, that's the great thing is networking and being a therapist and having that as my background. Wherever I went, what I loved about Honduras was it was all about who you knew. And over here, our idea, just like gangs, our idea of gang members over here is like a joke compared to the gangs in Central America. And so our idea of networking over here is completely different than how it is over there. Over there, you have nothing. So what you have is relationships. And that's what I would tell the person. I would say, start building relationships, get connections. You know, we went over there and we lived with a couple for 3 weeks because, you know, we had to get a place. We had to immerse ourselves, and they had lived there for several years. So without them, we would have been kind of screwed. Like, we wouldn't have known what we were doing or what, whatever. I would never, ever go to a country and say, I'm going to live here and do my cause and, you know, do my work without at least knowing two or three people.
Yeah.
And being able to stay on their couch was which is exactly what we did. Gav and I lived out of bags for 3 weeks and stayed on their couch, which pulled out. And basically, they said, this is what you need to know. Well, boom, boom, boom.
This is how you run a house.
This is how you do this.
This is where you learn the language.
And then what we did is turn around and did that for other people. So like other groups that came down, that's exactly what we did. We said, no, hang with us. We'll show you the local. We'll put you the real hunters. You'll see the real hunters, not just, you know, what mission trips see for a week, you know. I mean, we're going to show you like the nitty gritty, the real stuff.
Yeah.
So
I would find an organization either in a similar country or a similar area and find out what they're doing and how they're doing it and kind of model the structure after that, but kind of apply it to your own, whatever niche you're going to, whatever people group, or, you know, if you're doing education, then go that way. But the networking is going to be critical.
It's all about people. I mean, we had friends from all genres, all niches, all religions. I mean, it was crazy. Like we didn't, there was no judgment on anything, man. We were just like,
we had more.
If you talked to us and we could communicate, we were friends.
Yeah.
And if you needed a ride, we'd give you a ride. Or if you needed to borrow a car, I mean, that's how relationship worked over there. It was so giving. It was ridiculous. I mean, it was very humbling. I mean, let's put it that way. Like over here, we think, oh yeah, we give, you know, some money, or we give, you know, our time. But over there, man, they give their whole being. They give out of their heart, and it's like real, and it's powerful. It's powerful. I mean, it's influential. It is all about who you know. It's so relational. I mean,
yeah,
that's like my whole message right there is life is relational. It is what pierces our hearts, and it is what makes us come alive.
And what were y'all doing before y'all started that?
I was working for a subsidiary of Enron, which I lost my job, you know, shortly after we got back, which is great. It worked out well. I could clean up the house and get the nonprofit going.
Yeah, he did that. And I did counseling. I worked with the Department of Juvenile Justice. I did probation. And then I worked in some other programs with youth and adolescents that were in the system.
Were there any mistakes that you made that you could share with us that to help others from, or just lessons learned the hard way?
Do you have that kind of time? Because
choose one.
Let me give you an example. We had some people come down and said, we want to give you, what are they, red beans?
No.
They're black beans. They gave us black beans. We're doing a feeding
and
program.
And they donated 8 tons.
They donated like 4,000 pounds of black beans.
I mean, we worked with
USAID. So we're like,
we
thought we were in high cotton. So we roll up there with all these black beans. And people walk up. These people have not eaten in days. And they go, how ugly are those? I'm not eating those.
Really?
I'm like, what?
They only eat red beans.
They're like, oh, we eat red beans here. And they turned around and walked off.
Yeah, they don't like black beans.
I was like, what?
And we would mash them. We would do whatever we could to make it look like, but they didn't want.
There are some cultural issues that you need to be aware of whenever you're working in a foreign country. And just
always.
Like, you know, we surround ourselves with Hondurans to learn language, to understand the culture. Things like, you know, we would walk into our friend's house. They had a church in their house, and they were really like parents to us, and they spoke perfect English. However, they would not allow us to speak English, and they would be like, what do you want to drink? I said, I don't care. Just grab me something. I was going to kind of walk out the door, and she walked up to me, and she said, hijo, she's like, son, let me explain something to you. That's very rude.
Very rude.
In our culture, I understand you didn't mean it. But in our culture, it's very, when you say it's not important, it's very rude.
Yeah.
I said, oh.
So they're being great.
You know, there's a lot of intricacies to working in a foreign country that we don't realize because we, you know what I'm saying? That would be my biggest thing is to learn kind of the culture.
Yeah. And I teach sociology at the college here in Lakeland, Florida. And it's like, but until you live culture, you don't get it. Like I could teach it until you're blue in the face. And I could say, you know, you go, you work at organizations. I've worked at organizations, hospitals. I work on the psych unit as a social worker. And they'll tell you, you know, you take these cultural sensitive classes, you know, working with other cultures and everything. But until you live it and you actually experience it, you don't get it. Because as a woman, just as for gender purposes, you know, I basically never wore a pair of shorts ever again. Don't wear shorts. I mean, I wear them in my house in the evening and that's it. And somebody asked me the other day, they said, Nicole, you're always wearing jeans. It's summertime now. We're in Florida. Because over there, women wore dresses. They wore skirts and they wore things that covered their knees. And man, I picked that up right away. I was like, I'm not going to be able to wear these shorts here. This is just not. And you know, American teams would come down. Of course, you know, they're there for a week. But I was living there, and it was a whole different ballgame. So I really had to take into account out of respect.
We're a guest in that country.
Yeah, I'm a guest in this country. And then just to realize the humbling thing of feeling what it's like to be a minority. I mean, as a, you know, a Caucasian American, it's like you've never experienced that until you really live in another country. Not just go visit, but live
be a part
in
another country.
Because you're a minority. I mean, I would get into car accidents and it was the gringo's fault. I mean, it was my fault. You better pay. And it wasn't my fault, but because, you know, I was the minority, I was paying. It was my fault. And so those were some things that you just really had to take with a grain of salt and just be like, okay, this is learning. This is the journey. Was it hard at times? Absolutely.
It was the most challenging time of our lives. However, it was also the best time of my life. It stretched me more personally. It developed me as a human being more than I ever could have gotten
ever. And even our marriage. I mean, I remember looking at him one day going, you know, who are you? I mean, just the pressure of putting it on your marriage too, working together and then being in a total uncomfortable environment constantly. I mean, you're uncomfortable basically 2.5 years out of 3 years we were there. I mean, by the third year, I started to feel comfortable and then we just felt like it was time to go. And so it stretched our marriage. Yeah, I would never trade it for the world, but it was one of the hardest things I've ever done, for sure.
How long had y'all been married when y'all did that?
I think 5 or 6 years.
Yeah,
5 years, yeah. Because we were in our 20s.
So do you think surviving that event that y'all put yourselves in deepened your marriage?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, I think it strengthens your marriage when you work together because you basically have to communicate and work out the kinks regardless. You don't have a choice and you're living together. And I mean, there were days where I would look at him and say, you need to get me the HUAA hockey sticks out of this country. And he would smile and be like, okay, honey, I'll get you out of here. You know, but it was just one of those days where I was just like, you know, this is rough. This is hard.
You get up.
This is my family. Yeah. This is, everything's hard. Everything's a challenge. You know, you don't have Publix. You don't have Home Depot.
I got no running water. We haven't had power for 3 days.
Yeah.
Somebody broke into my car and I haven't even left the house yet.
Right. Like, so to counteract that, the times of just relationship, I mean, coming back here was harder than going.
Yeah.
I mean, I was so depressed. I missed my family.
Culture shock coming back is terrible.
Yeah, it was awful. And just the connections we had over there. I mean, we to this day, we're very close with the people there still. I mean, we still support people over there. We still talk to people over there on a regular basis. It's just really hard to come back to America where everybody's doing their own thing, trying to make a living, make money, and they're not really, they don't have a cause. I mean, some people do. I mean, some people want to reach the world and do things, but it's like, it's me and my own. And you know.
And you start seeing fruit of it after a while, your efforts. When you start seeing fruit of it, it really kind of puts it together and it's rewarding.
Yeah.
So what did bring y'all back home?
We just had a feeling it's time to come home. It's like, you know, I don't know what it is. You used to have this thing that was just time to come home.
We both had it.
It was kind of like these things where I was like, hey, I think we need to go home. Nicole's like, yeah, I know. And we had some really good like board of directors and people that here in the States that just, man, they supported us and they loved us and they prayed for us and they just, you know, went above and beyond for us. And we couldn't have stayed there without them. And I called one of them and said, hey, I think we're going to come home. He goes, yeah, I know. I'm like, what? He goes, yeah, I have known this for about 6 months. I said, well, why didn't you tell me? He's like, you wouldn't have heard it.
Yeah, we wouldn't have believed him. I would have laughed.
I was like, all right, this is an easier conversation than I was planning on having with you.
And Teen Challenge was rough. Doing the Teen Challenge program, you know, we had our car machete. It was rough. We were working with people that had killed people. I mean, these guys were 22-year-old. I mean, they would get into fights with me. They were very, but it's funny. I would tell people I felt more protected by those boys than anyone else. I knew they would take a bullet for me. So like, but it was hard. It was hard. And then dealing with other ministries actually was probably one of the hardest things because, man, they'll eat their own young.
Other nonprofit organizations.
I'm not trying to knock, you know, but man, to see the true colors.
Every issue you see in the churches here, which I don't know if you're a church person, but the jealousy, the striving, the backbiting, the competition,
so nasty.
You see there overseas. However, it's magnified like tenfold.
Yeah, it's really crazy.
And it's really crazy. Like, oh, can we borrow your tractor? I'm sorry, no. Why not? Because you don't go to our church.
Right. And Gavin and I weren't like that at all. We felt like we were called to help all ministries. So, we were called to unify them. And
so there was Mormons. We'd pick up Mormons and give them a ride. Yeah, and they're like, why are you picking me up? I'm like, you're from the States, aren't you? Like, yeah. They're like, Peace Corps people would be, you know, wander around. Hey, you need a lift? Yeah. Well, I'm not supposed to get a lift from strangers. Dude, I'm from Florida. You're from Utah.
Yeah.
Who cares? I'm not some sicko. I just try and hook a brother up, you know?
Did y'all mostly see that within the religious groups, or was it also the other nonprofits? Were there any non-religious nonprofits?
No, we saw. We had friends that were they weren't religious, but they were there humanitarian, and they were cool. Like, they didn't care, you know. They were like, whatever. But I mean, we were friends with Amish. I mean, we had some Australian guys.
Yeah, Mennonites, Amish, Peace Corps.
They were totally cool. Peace Corps. I mean, we rescued this one Peace Corps girl. She was out in this village.
Oh,
she was awful. I don't go there.
It was like the bar scene from Star Wars. Our house is down there. Was like, it's like everybody's there. It's like we got, you know, Amish talking to the Peace Corps talking to some hippies talking to Mennonites.
I loved it. I mean, see, I love that stuff. I think that's what the world's about. But we saw the worst among churches. Like, we would actually be accused because we were friends with everyone. I mean, we had Catholic friends, we had Baptist friends, you know, AG, Assemblies of God, and we would be accused of like trying to like take
undermine
over
authority,
like, or undermine. And we would just laugh. We were like, "Are you kidding me? Like, we're like not even into your religion at all. Like, we're just so."
I'm here to help people.
Yeah, we're here
I
to
don't
help.
Care. I don't care about doctrine.
It was really fun.
Not about doctrine.
I would laugh at them, and I don't think they took that kindly. They probably got mad about it.
Yeah, it sounds like they didn't quite understand.
Well, and because we had our own nonprofit, we were pretty much free to do whatever we wanted
to. Yeah, we could do whatever we want.
And it was awesome because our board of directors, like, do what you want to do. This is your ministry. This is your vision. This is your vision. We know you. We trust you. Do what you want to do.
Yeah.
So your board was supportive and not restrictive.
Absolutely. Exactly. So if we were under like a certain organization, you know, being over there, they would have been like, okay, you got to do X, Y, and Z.
Yeah, you need to plant churches.
You need to do this. You need to be in our office. If you're not doing stuff for us, you still need to be in our office.
Yeah, we didn't want to do that. So
I didn't want the control. It gets tough. So
it's just political, actually.
It is. So that's actually why we started our own nonprofit, because I didn't want people dictating what to do. Not that I have a problem with authority. My theory was, this is my dream and my vision is what I want to do. So I want to be able to do what I want to do.
And we have people helping us with it.
If you feel like you want to go to Africa and help some people, and I say, no, I'm sorry, Bentley, we don't have an opening in Africa, but we're going to send you to the Philippines to minister to, you know, people in the dump. You're not going to be very effective in the Philippines ministering to people in the dump if you want to be in Africa dealing with some tribe or something.
Yeah.
Because that's not your heart. Your heart is in Africa. So do what your heart is.
Yeah,
do what you're feeling like.
And that's the other thing about ministry. They'll put you where there's a need to be filled. And I always teach people, you need to work where you're deserved and where you're called, not where you're needed.
And we had people that wanted to come down and work with us. Like, what do you want me to do? I'm like, well, what do you feel like you're supposed to do? And they're like, well, what do you want me to do? I'm like, no.
Yeah,
what?
It's like spoon-fed. And
they'd look at me like I'm speaking French. I'm like, what do you feel like? You're kids. You want to build houses. You want to do school, education projects. You want a feeding program. What do you? And they're like, we don't
sometimes
know.
Sometimes they just come down to be with people.
Sometimes they just come down and hang out, which is great. We can totally honor that and totally use that.
Yeah.
But our whole thing when people came down is like, we want you to see this is what Missions is 101. You're staying in our house. You're seeing what we're doing. You're seeing exactly how we're living. And we want you to apply this to your life and see if this is a good fit for you.
Right.
One of the things I'd like to find out about is how technology did or did not play a role. Now, we know relationships are the thing and people are the thing. And I appreciate y'all pointing out because that is the most important thing.
I think right now, knowing what I know, technology is a lot easier for nonprofits to like fundraise. Because basically the idea of a nonprofit, especially if you're working overseas, is connect your program with the donors. You see, it's like what you're selling is a feeling to the donors. You're connecting your donors to either the houses you're building in this community or the people you're feeding or the kids you're putting in school. So, you know, when we were down in Honduras, our internet was bad. It wasn't working all the time.
It was dial-up.
Sometimes it was dial-up. Sometimes we didn't have power for 3 days. You know, we had a digital camera the size of a brick, and it was like 3 megapixels, and it was like $500. And, you know, and it was hard to get newsletters. We had to actually mail them, and email was tough.
Well, we had someone here in the States, and I did the newsletter once a month, and basically just did what Gavin said. I would connect, you know, what we were doing to the donors, like what was happening, and what they
now with Facebook and Twitter and Skype and
totally different
and,
world.
You know, Google Hangouts. You can like, it, let's say, okay, Bentley, you're supporting this kid in Honduras. We can put this kid, you know, on a Skype call with you. You can see him and talk to him. Hey, did you get the clothes I sent? Hey, did you get the school supplies I sent? Oh, great. How's your mom? What's
you
going
on? Translator,
you know what I'm saying? You could do it through a translator, but you can actually see this kid and see how he's doing and, you know, establish a relationship with him. So if you came down and visited him, sometime, you would know him and have a relationship with him.
Well, we didn't have that back then.
And we weren't able to do that and weren't able to do it very easily. And I think that would really make a difference. That you know what you sent goes to this child overseas. You talk to the child, you know what I'm saying?
100%.
And you have a connection with them.
Yeah.
And with Twitter and Facebook, you know, anybody's an email away or a tweet away or a...
Well, just the people we know down there, that's how we connect with them now. It's so cool because...
Like the girl that had the heart surgery? The girl that had the heart surgery? She's on Facebook.
Yeah.
Her brother who's in med school, he's on Facebook.
Yeah, I just Skyped him the other day.
Are they mostly using cell phones at that point or...
Well, over there they have internet cafe. So, I mean, so cool because, yeah, you just walk in.
Well, and the brother that's in med school, when he started 4 years ago, I bought him a laptop, I bought him a printer, I went down and basically set him up with all the stuff he would need to.
Yeah.
So he's got a laptop and there's a lot of internet cafes, and I think he has internet actually in his house now, in his apartment. He shares with a couple of guys.
That is actually expensive over there for them.
So what are you guys up to now? We mentioned your compassions earlier in the episode, and they were a little different from what you were doing then.
Well, see, I think everybody goes through like seasons in their like compassion stuff. So while we were on the mission field, people were working here to support us. And now we've kind of reversed that, where we're here, like, you know, we're doing businesses and we're raising our own kids now, but we're also supporting a bunch of other people overseas and doing, you know, kind of facilitating that stuff. Since we've come back, you know, there's been a lot of needs where people are like, I don't know how to start a nonprofit. We have a lady that works in Africa. We have somebody who works in Haiti, and we've been able to help them get their nonprofits going. Personally, I really like teaching like financial freedom, how to escape a cubicle, how to be able to make money and be independent. So if you want to go to Honduras for a month, you can do that.
You know what I'm saying? Well, you do it via real estate.
And I do it, via real estate investing and that type of stuff.
And then mine really hasn't changed. I just totally believe that people can be free emotionally, mentally, physically, spiritually, you know, and all those four areas. And so I feel like I just kind of carry that on with my coaching and consulting. I started a podcast working with men because I have worked with men for so long. I've worked with Teen Challenge and then even Department of Juvenile Justice. You know, most of my caseload was boys that were in trouble in the system. And my heart is to see a man really become a real man and be free so that he can pass that on to his family and his wife and his children and his business and all of those areas, you know, because what I see is that men are maybe free financially and in entrepreneurship, but they're not free in relationships. You know, they don't have success in those other areas of their life, or maybe health or mental, you know, or emotional health. So right now I'm kind of doing that. I do a lot of coaching and consulting, and then I have a podcast called Real Time, Real Men Only, where I just basically interview men. And my goal, I don't really say it too often, but really it's to get to the heart of the man and that masculinity and just seeing those gender roles, you know, especially as a woman, being over in Honduras, it was funny because I'm very strong, opinionated and independent woman.
Really? I couldn't tell.
I know. Can you imagine? And so the pastors, of course, would be like, Nicole, you know, why don't you go into the kitchen?
Just be a little more.
Yeah. Why don't you go in the kitchen with the other ladies and help out? And, you know, I'm sitting here. I'm literally, you know, and any woman that thinks that we don't have rights here in America, I mean, go live in another country, because I teach this in sociology at the college here. I say, listen, man, we got it good here. Okay. Because in any other country, especially Latin America, you are seen as someone who needs to be in the kitchen. You need to keep your mouth quiet. And basically I would have to do that. I mean, I had to kind of
learn
and live under those rules for a certain period, but then for some reason, I don't know, I was given an opportunity to speak and teach. The doors kind of opened for me to do that. So over here, I just feel like, you know, just to see the heart of a man and to see that strength and that masculinity rise to that occasion, I feel like it's a benefit to women. And it helps women to see that and respect men. And really what I'm trying to do is just calm down the war of the sexes here. So I don't know what that's going to look like. It's all unfolding, you know, with this podcast. And I'm definitely going to do a podcast called Real Time, Real Women Only. So we'll see how it goes. But yeah, that's what we're doing now. We're raising our kids. You know, we got a 5-year-old and 1.5-year-old. So we're doing that. That's fun stuff. You never knew your capability of compassion or love until you have a child. It's quite crazy. I mean, you think you're selfless and, you know, all this when you're out on the mission field, but then when you have kids, you're like, oh, I was really that selfish. Yeah, I was thinking about that tonight. I was like, man, you don't realize your capability of loving until you have a child. So it's crazy.
Yeah, until you have someone completely dependent on you for their life and for everything.
Yes, that is crazy.
How can people kind of support your efforts going forward?
Well, for mine right now, what I do... I do a lot of counseling and stuff here locally, and I find that the need is just as much here in America as it is in other countries. And so right now I have a family, I have a lot of children, and the husband at 40 had a stroke and just completely
died.
I mean, he should have been dead. I mean, it's crazy. And he's kind of a miracle. They call him the miracle man. And so right now I'm going to put up the donation site on my website, Wrap with Nick. It's not up right now, but I'm working with my web girl to do that because he's doing some different treatments. And it's just crazy, just all of the things that this family has been through the past couple of years. I've been really connected with them, a lot of loss and stuff. What I'm seeing in America is how we cope with loss, you know, death. It could be a death of someone or just crisis, you know, not having a job. Foreclosure on your home. My kind of cause right now is just to help people grieve and deal with loss. Gavin and I both lost our mentors that, you know, we've had for years that coached us through businesses. Gavin's mentor, Michael Martin, he was amazing. And then my best friend of 20 years, Elizabeth. So it was crazy, you know, and it was like back to back, like 2 years of loss. And it was just weird walking through that experience because now, gosh, the compassion that I have and that I'm moved for when, you know, someone's talking to me and they've lost their child at 10 years old to cancer or something, it's crazy. And I'm thinking, well, how are you dealing with this? And you know, the dad is telling me, well, I kind of haven't dealt with it. It's been years and I really haven't. And so right now that's like my cause is just to educate and teach people and write about grief, write about loss and this world we're living in and to see the bigger picture, you know, and to give hope. I mean, I named my daughter, my best friend of 20 years died 2 weeks later after my daughter was born and her name is Hope and Hope Elizabeth was her name. That's kind of one of my causes. And then to continue supporting Honduras because we do school sponsorship, I believe as a professor, you know, education is it, man. And over there, you know, the girls, they're meant to be maids or nannies. They're not even allowed to go to school. So it's crazy. I mean, what you hear on TV, that's so true. Like in Africa, I mean, all these other countries. So we still support that big time. And we're definitely going to have some venues on my side, at least, to where people can donate or, you know, give to that cause.
Yeah, I have to chime in. Yeah, we're supporting Alexander Medical School. Us personally, nobody else helps. It's just us. Putting them through med school. We're plugged in with a bunch of organizations. And, you know, if somebody really wanted to get involved down there, really good organizations that I know and I trust.
Yeah.
Just drop us an email.
Oh, yeah.
I know people at orphanages that you can go down there and play with the kids. And they're just good people.
Yes.
You know, I know a couple from Texas. They were in their 70s and said we were going to retire. And they just went to Honduras in the middle of nowhere and built an orphanage.
They're amazing.
With like 150 kids. And I'm like, wow. Who does this? And I'm just like, well, we just kind of felt like it'd be something to do for retirement.
Yeah.
So we know some really great organizations that, you know, you're not going to see there. They don't have big fancy websites and they don't, you know, do all kinds of advertising, but they just run some really amazing programs and they just have some really amazing kids and can just go and see these kids and go, oh my gosh, this is good stuff.
And that's what I want to add about technology. You know, it's cool to have, you know, the latest and the greatest and all these. It's awesome, you know, to have the donations right at your fingertips and whatever. But man, I'm telling you, when you get in the trenches and you meet people like who Gavin's talking about, this older couple, well, we know several couples that started orphanages over there. It's gold. It's like you've hit a gold mine because these people are just so amazing. They don't even care about like the whole technology side of it, although they probably should because it probably would help them out a bit better, you know, and maybe that's a business idea, you know, some